Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pace. Last weekend, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania was removed from an airplane because a fellow passenger was concerned about his quote-unquote cryptic notes. The notes this Italian economist was working on turned out to be a complex math problem, but because of his so-called Mediterranean looks and mysterious scribbles, he was targeted as a potential terrorist. This comes after a much-publicized incident last month when a UC Berkeley student, Khairuddin Maksoumi, was removed from an airplane for speaking Arabic. While the Department of Homeland Security urges people to follow its "if you see something, say something" mantra, these recent incidents have sparked debate about racial and religious profiling and have brought to the fore the Islamophobia insinuating its way into American politics this election season. The Bay Area has one of the largest Muslim populations in the United States, with over 250,000 Muslims residing in San Francisco and the surrounding counties. A diverse group, Muslims represent a mix of racial and ethnic groups. How have Bay Area Muslims been impacted by increasing fears about Islamic extremism and terrorism? Can we be smart about responding to terrorism without threatening civil liberties? And how can we decouple concerns about Islamic extremism from the way we perceive Muslims in general? To discuss this and more, I'm pleased to be joined in the studio tonight by Yunus Morshid. He is adjunct professor of communication studies at Cal State East Bay, a Fulbright scholar with a master's in linguistics and communication, and a PhD in international and intercultural education from USC. Yunus also happens to be a long-term friend of mine. Welcome, Yunus, to the program.
Thank you, Joseph.
And we're also joined by phone tonight by two guests. The first is Zahra Bilou. She is executive director of the San Francisco chapter of the Council of American Islamic Relations. Zahra is a graduate of CSU Long Beach and UC Hastings School of Law. Welcome, Zahra.
Thank you so much for having me.
And finally, we're joined by Nasreena Bargzi. She is national security and civil rights attorney at Asian American Advancing Justice Asian Law Caucus. Nasreena is a graduate of UC Berkeley School of Law. Welcome, Nasreena.
Happy to be here.
And always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. I'll give you that phone number now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment at the KLW website or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. We were supposed to be joined tonight by Khairuddin Maksoumi, the senior at UC Berkeley, who was removed from an airplane last month for speaking Arabic. Unfortunately, at the last minute, he could not join us due actually to a traveling conflict. And so we want to have him speak in his own voice, and we'll represent that by playing a clip that was posted on the Washington Post website. Let's go ahead and play that clip.
When I sat down on the plane, I called my uncle through Viper. He lives in Baghdad, the capital. And I told him that, you know, I'm sorry, I couldn't ask you a question, but the event was really good. And he was, like, asking me, how was it? And then while I was speaking with him, one lady, she was sitting in front of me. She turned around and she started looking at me. And I felt there is something weird. 2 minutes later, one of the Southwest employee, he came to me. He said, sir, I need to step out of the plane right now. I stood up and I went outside the plane. So after stepping out of the plane, we were standing on the hallway, and there was three police officers. And he started telling me that as if I am having a serious conversation. And I told him, no, I was talking to my uncle. I went to an event. I pulled up my phone. I showed him the video. And he said, you know, that why would I speak in the plane? And, you know, the environment around us, you know, what's happening on the airport. And I told him that I am sorry. I didn't mean to do that. And he said, what you have done. The plane is going to be delayed for about 20, 30 minutes because of you. And I told him, no, this is, I think, what Islamophobia got this country into. And the moment I said it, he was very angry. And he said, you know what? You're not going back to the plane. And the police officer reached to his device and he said, call FBI, call FBI. And that it was an overwhelming moment when, you know, someone calling the FBI, it's big. We went to a room. They asked me many questions. And then the FBI agent, she left to meet with the guy who pulled me out of the plane. And then she came back and she said, Khairuddin, you need to be honest with us and tell us everything about Martyr. And I just looked at her. I was like, I looked at her. And I said, I have never said that word.
So that was a clip of Carol Dean Maksumi speaking about his experience on a Southwest Airlines flight last month. I wanted to use that clip as a bouncing off point for each of our guests to respond. When you heard that story the first time tonight, what was going through your mind, both as a person for whom this issue is very important, but also as you think about this issue on the larger national stage, as it seems to be front and center in the political debate? Let's start with you, Eunice Morshid, in the studio.
Yeah, I of course here we don't have the full set of data about the kind of conversation, what was being said from the other side. Who was the woman that reported him? What's her, you know, I mean, there are so many factors to account for here. Her psychological state, we know that when people fly, some people are in high anxiety and they just need a very small stimulus, like an Arabic speaking person or an Arabic looking person, to trigger some sort of a response. So we don't have a full set of information. What I was thinking about in terms of the word shaheed, which means martyr, many families in the Arab and the Muslim world have named their sons shaheed during the early 20th century, because many of these men died for their country's independence from colonial powers. And this is the experience of many Muslims in the Middle East and North Africa. It is just not a name that denotes a martyr. It's also a name that denotes an era in the Middle East and in North Africa where Muslims were fighting foreign forces, mostly European forces. So it's just that it is very unfortunate that a word like shaheed triggers such a response and an outcome that denotes the larger framework that we need to discuss here, which is the fear of the other. What do we do when there is somebody around that looks different? And we can choose to use our rational mind, and we can also choose a historical response to what is going on around us. And it seems like this is a really a good instance of a historical, emotional response to a situation that did not warrant the outcome that we are talking about.
So I want to go to our phone guests as well to get their response. And again, to for the record there, Carol Dean Maksumi said that he didn't actually say the word shaheed, but that is what the person who purportedly overheard him say. So, but an important point that you're making, but I just want to, for the record, say he didn't actually say that word. So let's go to Zahra Bilou. What's your take when you hear him talk about this story of his experience?
Right. So I don't know. I want to say I've been blessed and burdened to have heard the story multiple times. We're working closely with Carol Dean to assess what his options are and understand better how this fits in the context of other people experiencing this. And so when he first told me about it, and again, when I heard it right now, my immediate reaction is, this is every Muslim airline passenger's worst nightmare. Many Muslims will say that when they get on a plane, they are worried about this kind of thing happening. And what concerns me is that one woman's word, whether she is rightfully or wrongfully triggered, could unleash a chain reaction of this sort. He was searched by multiple law enforcement agencies. He was interrogated. He was humiliated. He was traumatized. And then, as if to make matters, to add insult to injury, Southwest doesn't put him on the next flight, which is, it doesn't solve the problem, but at least has been the case in some of these incidents. Southwest refunds him his money, leaves him stranded at LAX to find another way to get home. I don't understand how anyone could hear this story and not be frightened, but also incredibly frustrated that this could happen just because one person said that they heard something.
Nazreena Barghzi, with the Asian Law Caucus, your take on this?
You know, it exemplified for me exactly what's wrong with programs like If You See Something, Say Something. When you have broad programming like that set up against an environment where Islamophobia and anti-Muslim rhetoric is coming from our presidential candidates, what ends up happening is you get folks who are scared. When you get folks who are scared, you get folks reporting people in the manner that this guy was reported here. If you see something, say something means to people anything that you find to be frightening, you report in. And my organization has been working with the ACLU and with a law firm to actually bring a lawsuit against the Suspicious Activity Act program, which rests on this idea of having people report people into these systems. And what ends up happening, unsurprisingly, is that you see a disproportionate number of these reports against people of Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, or South Asian descent. And what this example falls into is that pattern of people from these communities, myself included, I'm an Afghan American Muslim, you see that these folks are disproportionately targeted and that the weight of this country's national security is put on them, and often it is completely unwarranted. And the other thing I just want to note is, you know, the bewilderment in this guy's voice as he talks about his experience. And as Zahra was saying, you know, every American Muslim basically has this fear when they get on a plane or when they experience anything like this. But at the same time, any human being has this reaction of, I can't believe this is actually happening to me.
So I want to go back for a moment to Zahra, because I wanted to hear about what statistics your organization keeps or other organizations keep around the amount of incidents like this around the country in the last 6 to 12 months.
So in the last 6 to 12 months, there have been at least half a dozen, if not more, complaints like this that have received some form of publicity. And just maybe a week or two ago, I heard from someone who said they experienced something similar, said they wanted to come forward, didn't even take the first step to call for help, despite multiple assurances that help is available. And I hear those kinds of stories also from advocates and attorneys working on these cases, is that there are as many, if not more, anecdotal reports that we're hearing about as there are official reports. And they come from a number of airlines. I think this weekend there was another one involving someone who looked Arab American but was indeed not. And so our concern is that they seem to be, in a good way, getting more visibility. And I would credit much of that to social media and supportive mainstream and legacy media that are saying, hey, this is a problem. And so though there have been ongoing complaints for the last year, the last thing I'll say about this is that the phrase flying while Muslim talks about these experiences, but also other travel issues that American Muslims and those who look and are mistaken for American Muslim often experience. And that phrase is older than the last 6 to 12 months, because this has been going on for much longer. But I'm hopeful, because people are now talking about it more and publicly pushing back against it.
So let's take a step back for a moment and think of the current environment in which these types of reactions and responses are occurring. Because I think one of the hopes that we can get to in this hour is, how do we decouple the concerns around Islamic extremism that has led to many acts of violence from painting a broad brush of Muslims in general? What I wanted to do is, how do you see these events in the setting of recent attacks in Paris and San Bernardino and Brussels within the political landscape of the American presidential election? How do you make sense of all of these different inputs, and how it boils down to the potential experience of the average Muslim American? Why don't we start with you, Nasreena Barksi?
So I think what's happening here is that you have candidates who are taking advantage of the current environment and scapegoating people in a similar manner that we saw in World War II as against Japanese Americans who were sent to concentration camps for four years during that war. And I think the reality is to hold accountable a religion of 1.8 billion people in adherence, and as we mentioned, not just folks who are adherents of the religion, but folks who are perceived to be adherents, is it's just downright silly, and it's an impossible thing to actually implement. So you're seeing, you know, a group of extremists who happen to be using, you know, words related to Islam for their sort of own political and other agendas, and you're seeing a political system within this country that's willing to really just focus on that and run with that instead of doing real police work, instead of doing real kind of digging in and doing the policy work that's necessary to get at solutions that will actually protect this country without compromising the civil rights and civil liberties, not just of American Muslims, but all of us. Because the reality is, if anyone out there thinks that this is only affecting American Muslims, you're completely wrong, because once a right is taken away from one group, it is only a matter of time before it extends to every single person out there.
Eunice Murshid, do you want to add something there?
Sure. I think when we look at the history of our nation has a history of scapegoating a group, a minority, and we have a massive history in doing that. This country has been founded by people who were fleeing persecution. They came here, and then they displaced people who were the natives of this land. And that is the basis of how this country was founded. It was founded on tension, on displacement, on running away from persecution to build something that's new. And we have seen groups over the years, even from the mainstream culture, the Irish have been targeted, the Italians have been targeted, the Jews have been targeted, the African American people have been targeted, the Chinese have been targeted, and then the Hispanics have been targeted. And this is the turn for the Muslims to be targeted right now. We always need to find somebody to scapegoat, because there is a lack of feeling a sense of wholeness and identity without feeling superior to somebody else. And I think this is a really a learning moment where educators and journalists really need to use these moments to really educate the larger population about what is really going on here. There is a history from both sides. Terrorism is a reality. Do terrorists speak for Islam? Absolutely not. And I think what is really lacking that we see here, that I really hope will open the door for, is that we do not engage in perspective getting. We do not get the stories directly from the Muslim people living in America and in Europe, and how they are being affected by this whole mess that is going on right now. And we forget that we are all in this together. This thing called life, we're all in it together. And we cannot find or build communities by scapegoating a member of that community or a group of that community. So I do believe that we can turn these conversations into something much bigger. And I really appreciate that, for example, President Obama has stopped using in the same sentence the word Islam and terrorism, because he understands the impact of doing so. And I'll stop at that.
So I'm curious to build on Eunice's point there of, you know, this is part of just a longer thread of groups of people that have been scapegoated, as he says, in this country. To both you, Nasreena and Sarah, do you see this as part and parcel of that thread? Do you see unique elements to it?
I mean, I have colleagues that will say that Islamophobia is, is an offshoot, a younger sibling of white supremacy, of racism. It's really important for me in my work to talk about how white supremacy, racism, imperialism has impacted numerous communities before the Muslim community, but we're also trying to get better about acknowledging that the targeting of those communities has not ended in all cases. An unarmed black man, like, more likely to be killed by a police officer than a South Asian Muslim person, right? And so many of our communities are interrelated. It's estimated that one-third of American Muslims are African American, and so I'm always cautious about how we frame our relation to other struggles so that we don't erase other struggles or erase other parts of our community. I also am challenged in part by the framing of Islamic extremism, or how we talk about terrorism and the way it impacts Americans. Terrorism is a tactic of war. It's perpetuated by stateless actors. And when we destabilize so much of the world due to our foreign policy, our upholding of dictatorships and corrupt leaders, I have a hard time being surprised that we are now, all of us, facing the consequences of so much violence and killing. Like, we can't continue to do what we do as a country and stay safe, right? For many people in parts of the world, all they know about us is the bombs that we drop on them. And so for me, it's not a question of, do those terrorists represent Islam or not? I want, as an American taxpayer, for us to spend more money building schools and funding water supplies, as opposed to billions going to Israel and Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, leading to more people hating us, which I worry fuels these attacks, doesn't keep us any safer, doesn't make us any safer.
And where does that point of view, the point of view you just shared and that of Eunice's, where does that get traction? Does it get traction anywhere? And if not, why not?
I think that's a great question, right? It's something that a lot of people in the anti-war movement have been asking for some time, is why are we spending money in all of the wrong ways? It's a conversation that many civil rights groups are now having in pushing back against the government's efforts to allegedly counter violent extremism, is that you can't target a single religious community, one, because that is itself unconstitutional and problematic, but two, simplifying the question of violent extremism as one of just religion doesn't do us any service. And I worry that we're not any safer today than we were a few years ago. And part of that is because we're not addressing the full problem.
Nasreena, did you want to add something there?
Yeah, you know, I think it's important to remember that history has seen this before. You know, our country has a history of reacting boldly to perceived national security threats in ways that are almost always later regretted. So the Alien Sedition Act of 1798 were, in response to national security threats, intended to protect the homeland. Instead, the act was used to politically persecute reporters and activists criticizing the government. And then later, the act is promptly rescinded. Then, you know, during the American Civil War, you have President Lincoln suspending habeas corpus, and the result was 13,000 civilians being detained without review. And then the act was later declared unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court after the war. World War One saw the Espionage Act and the 1918 Sedition Act, and you know, as a result of intense propaganda by the Wilson administration to support the need for this act, there was a rise in hysteria against people of German descent, and you know, President Roosevelt later granted amnesty to those persecuted under the act. And in World War Two, as I mentioned earlier, you had 120,000 Japanese Americans stripped of their property and freedom and sent to concentration camps for 4 years. And then later in the 80s, you have an apology issued, reparations paid, and with President Reagan, of all people, apologizing and Congress passing the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. So I think one of the important questions that we need to ask ourselves is, why do we keep doing this and apologizing about it later? And you know, the work that Zahra and others are doing in our community is to try to say, okay, well, we know our history. We're going to try to stop it before it happens now. But the problem is it's happening, even though there are so many of us trying to work against it as it's happening, and everything is further complicated by globalization and the, you know, greater interconnectedness of communities to one another. So it's all very related, but I think ultimately it comes down to this question of, you know, how do we create an environment where we can hold ourselves accountable while a national security environment exists? And I think history has shown that secrecy and focusing on groups of people because of race or religion have not fared well as strategies. They've not worked, nor have they been anything that we've been proud of as a nation. So we need to learn from that history and, you know, take those things off the table. But in the current political environment, we're seeing that environment basically recreate itself.
So, Eunice, I know you wanted to say something here. I wanted to also see if you could take a crack at Nasreena's question, why do we keep doing this and then apologize for it later?
I don't know. I think that's a question that I cannot individually answer for a whole nation. I think it's a very complicated question, and the answer lies in the hunger for power. There is such a hunger for power that we forget to learn from our lessons. And you can see this very clearly when President Obama speaks about becoming students of history and learning from our mistakes. And when he made overture to people from the Middle East, and the first thing that he did, he went to Cairo and he gave his speech. He was deeply criticized by a lot of people. We America, we do not apologize. We Americans, we do not have dialogue. It's an expression of extreme arrogance. And when you are in that position of arrogance, you do not create dialogue, you do not create harmony, and you do not get perspective of what's going on with the other people. Let me point out something that's very important, a statistic. There are 3.3 million Muslims living in the United States. There are 19 million Muslims living in Europe. The European Muslims are having a hard time because the Europeans failed at this thing called multiculturalism. They did not integrate Muslims very well. And the highest number of recruits in ISIS and Al-Qaeda come from Europe because there is a large majority of youth who do not have a purpose, who feel completely marginalized, who have become a victim of this very extreme twisted ideologies. By contrast, here in the United States, before 9/11, Muslims thrived. They did very well. They lived in an environment where they could worship, they could be themselves, they could pursue education, they could pursue business, and they thrived. Therefore, we do not have many recruits from the United States going into ISIS, going into Syria, going into other places. So part of the answer is we really have to provide opportunities for integration of people and get them to be allies and our friends in solving the problem. But when Muslims feel that they're being targeted, they're being watched over, that they're being kicked out of a plane, they're being criticized, and then we have people who aspire to the position of becoming president of the United States, putting Muslims in such a demonic position, then it's very difficult for that community to be a helping hand.
So I want to push back a little bit on that and ask you then, and the other guests as well, how do we make sense of San Bernardino, the Boston Marathon bombing? How do you make sense of that? Do you see that as a trend? Do you see that as isolated incidents? How do you give the appropriate attention and focus to something like that when you're trying to draw a distinction between how Muslims had fared pre 9/11 in the United States compared to Muslims in Europe?
I think, you know, Muslims are not immune to mental illness and psychological trauma. We have cases in this country where kids have taken guns to school and killed their classmates and their teachers. We talk about it in the news. We may cry about it a little bit. We may have a debate about gun control, and then it's history. We do not make it as a Christian problem or a Jewish problem or any kind of faith problem. But when a man or a woman have mental problems, but they go and conduct some horrible act, then it becomes a conversation about their faith and their religion. And then their whole religion is in the trial seat. These are the kind of hypocrisies that we need to really face with incredible honesty and rigorous integrity.
Nasreena and Zahra, I want you to get a chance to respond there as well.
Yeah, just to echo that, I would say, you know, if we look at the attack on the Planned Parenthood Center last year, it appears that that gentleman, you know, says he was highly motivated by Christian doctrine, and he's somebody who has a clear mental health issue, and the way that has been reported and experienced by folks here as well, it should be, is that this is somebody who has a mental health issue, and we really need to talk about mental health in this country and about gun control to address sort of how we need to approach folks having access to these types of weapons. And for me, you know, San Bernardino and some of these other incidents in the Boston bombing that you pointed to fall in that exact line of cases.
And Zahra?
I agree with everything that's been said. I think that, and I would add, going back to what I was saying earlier, is that, so let's look at mental health, let's look at gun control, let's look at what is motivating so many of these people. And when we're thinking of Muslims who might be engaged in violence, who are facing mental illness issues, who have access to guns because of bad gun control laws, we're also faced with the challenge of not being able to consistently and honestly say that violence is bad and no one should engage in it, because the way some of these groups, and this is going to be true whether we're talking about inner city gangs or we're talking about ISIS, the way some of these groups recruit is by pointing to the inconsistencies of the mentors, the teachers, and the civic leaders that are attempting to prevent violence.
This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're joined by Zahra Bilou, Executive Director of the San Francisco Chapter of the Council of on American Islamic Relations. Excuse me, Council of, is it Council on or Council of?
Council on American Islamic Relations.
Okay, Council on American Islamic Relations. We're also joined by Nasreena Barghzi, National Security and Civil Rights Attorney at Asian American Advancing Justice, part of the Asian Law Caucus, and Eunice Morshid here in the studio, Adjunct Professor of Communications Studies at Cal State East Bay. We invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. This is a very interesting and very rich topic. We'd like to hear your perspective as citizens of the Bay Area. What do you think about concerns around terrorism and how it's been used to paint a broad brush of Muslim Americans and Muslims in general? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you are Muslim or have been mistaken for Muslim, have you faced discrimination? Tell us your stories, 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. Let's go to Louise from Berkeley. Louise, welcome to the program.
Hello. I noticed one of the speakers twice referred to the Japanese in concentration camps, and I wanted to draw a distinction between, actually the person I called in wasn't sure the correct term she used, internment camps, I was thinking detention, but internment I think is more precise than concentration camps.
Okay, thanks Louise for your comment. I heard internment camps as well. All right. So I wanted to take a step back here to something you said earlier, Eunice, which is that it's going to take education and communication to make this work. Yeah. What does that actually look like?
Well, it looks like some things that we've done that we've succeeded at. Let me give you an example. Let me draw a distinction between what is perspective taking and perspective getting. Perspective taking is something that we can engage in if we have a level of empathy for the other, which is to understand what it means to be in somebody else's shoe. And that's using our sixth sense. You can have the skills to do that. You can have the skills to be aware enough of your own interpretive bias and your own stereotypes, etc. And you can understand. You can try to guess what it feels to be Muslim living in our times. Perspective getting is very different. It's a step beyond that. It requires a little bit of courage and engagement, which is to actually speak directly to the people, in this case, speaking to Muslims and getting really directly their experience. There is something that's really important that happened in Afghanistan. The army, they decided they're going to recruit, they're going to get the citizens in Afghanistan involved in protecting them from the Taliban. So they spent $200 million on creating this campaign. They gave them a phone number to call. If they saw a Taliban coming into town, they needed to call that number so that it alerts the army and they come into the defense before they commit an act of terrorism. Months and months went by and nobody is calling. So the army general is engaged in perspective taking, which is guessing. Well, maybe they're not calling because they're afraid that their family might be killed. Maybe they're calling because they don't know how to use a cell phone. They stopped there. And then one general said, let's go and talk to people and find out what is going on. That's perspective getting. They went out there to the community and they interviewed people and they found out that the Taliban knew about this before they come to town to disable all the towers of the cell phone towers so nobody can call. So in the beginning, they all got it wrong. But once they talked to people, they began to get a perspective about what's really going on. And that perspective helped in changing course.
So it's really about changing the way not only we talk about it, but who gets to talk about it.
Exactly. And there is something that really bothers me a great deal. When anything happens, the pundits in the media go, where are the Muslims? Why aren't they speaking? Why aren't they protesting? It shows an incredible depth of ignorance among this so-called and called journalist, because nobody speaks for Islam. The Muslim world is so diverse, is so large, that no one can speak for it. And there is no center like the Vatican for the Catholics. Saudi Arabia is not the center of Islam. Mecca is there. That's part of the pilgrimage. But the Wahhabi brand of Islam in Saudi Arabia does not speak for Muslims or Islam. That is a very small, unique, difficult brand of Islam that most Muslims do not relate to. So therefore, this question of who do you take to becomes really a very, very important question. And I want to read to you a quote from a director of a medical hospital in Brussels after the Brussels attack. And the next day he was asked by journalists why he and his community were not out in the streets protesting about this. So let me pull the quote here. And this is really very revealing about this idea. Here is what he says. "Because we are driving the taxis that have been taking the population home for free since yesterday, because we are caring for the wounded in hospitals, because we are driving the ambulances that are racing through the street like shooting stars to try to save what life remains in us, because we are at the reception desks of the hotels that have been welcoming onlookers for free since yesterday, because we're driving buses, the trams, and the subway cars so that life can continue, because we are still wounded, because we are still looking for criminals in our police, investigators, and magistrate outfit, because we are crying for our dead, because we are no more spared than anyone else, because we are undoubtedly triple bruised." And he goes on and on and on and on. This tells us that when these activities happen of terror, the first people that are impacted by it are the Muslims themselves. And they have to make sense of it, make sense of this thing that is very, very complicated. And this is, and if you talk to Muslims directly, if you give them airtime, you will get that perspective.
So I want to go to one of our callers. We have Parvez from Alameda. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I'm a Muslim American. I was born in Afghanistan, grew up in the United States. And the sad part is that, you know, if the German pilot last year, you know, deliberately crashed an airplane full of passengers, and nobody talks about his fate, you know, they all talk about, you know, he had a mental issue, he broke up with his girlfriend, whatever happened, and nobody talks about if he was Christian, if he was Jew, whatever he was, nobody talks about it. But if any sick Muslim does anything, it becomes the whole religion fault. All the Muslims, you know, I as a Muslim feel like a victim, truly, because the ISIS, the Taliban, the Boko Haram, they don't represent me. They don't represent what I stand for. Nothing. But now I feel like a victim, because if I walk and I'm get on an airplane because I'm Muslim, I could be thrown out of the airplane because somebody feels threatened by me. You know, even though I'm American, I'm probably more patriotic than most Americans are.
Thank you so much, Parvez, for sharing your perspective.
Thank you.
I'll put that phone number out again if you want to join our conversation here at City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 as we talk about Islamophobia broadly, but also how is the Bay Area experiencing it? With our guest Zahra Bilou of the Council on American Islamic Relations, Nasrina Bargzi of the Asian Americans Advancing Justice, part of the Asian Law Caucus, and Eunice Morshid, Adjunct Professor of Communication Studies at Cal State East Bay. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. Do you want to say something there, Eunice?
Sure. The caller, Parvez, the example that he gave us of the pilot of the German airline that crashed the entire plane and killed everybody else. The way that the Germans and the European Union dealt with this is the way that we hope that they will deal with every single incident in the future. They used their rational mind. They collected data before they rushed into making generalization. They understood very well the impact of any hasty generalization that they will engage in. It is very sad that when this is happening, and there is a Muslim involved or an Arab involved, then the rhetoric and the narrative is very, very different. It switched from rationality into emotion, into fear, into going onto the attack. And that's the switch. That is really the switch.
A switch towards reactivity. Zahra Bilou, I wanted to get your take. How is CARE responding to this? How are they trying to take over or have a seat at the table when it comes to changing or creating an alternative narrative here, like Eunice is mentioning?
I think the first part is, you know, raising awareness about Islamophobia. One thing that I haven't mentioned and that hasn't come up yet is that part of our advocacy and education efforts at CARE have included researching who is spreading anti-Muslim sentiment. In a couple of years ago, we published a report that looked at a couple of dozen organizations that together were spending over $100 million over just the course of a few years doing things like buying anti-Muslim bus ads, lobbying elected officials who then go on to make these statements, attempting to pass model anti-Islam legislation or template anti-Islam legislation from state to state, training law enforcement officers, and so on. And so this isn't all happening in a vacuum. And so I wanted to make sure to mention that, so that when there is an attack like what we saw in Paris or San Bernardino, yes, there are people that are going to jump to irrational conclusions out of fear, but also in part because they have been fed a narrative over and over again. A really important step for us is critical steps for us. One is engaging with the media to push back against the narrative, to challenge problematic frames, but also terminology that blames the whole Muslim community or associates the whole Muslim community with the actions of individuals in a way that we would not tolerate for any other community. And so working with media to put forward authentic Muslim narratives. And then the other one is working with our fellow Americans to marginalize Islamophobia. I don't know that we would say that we're advocating for the illegalization or the criminalization of Islamophobia. We're advocates of free speech, but we are saying that this should not be socially acceptable, in the same way that one could not say the N-word in polite company or should never say it anywhere or anything else of that sort. We want to push to ensure that people don't think that it's okay to marginalize the Muslim community. And so that's, I think, where it's really important. Over 70% of Americans have never personally met a Muslim, and so we ask our fellow Americans to get to know their Muslim neighbors, but we also work with Muslims to say, hey, like, get to know your fellow Americans so that they can see that you're concerned about the same things that they're concerned about, that you have the same safety and rent and job issues that they have.
Nasreena, I wanted to ask you, as the title of the group you're with is National Security and Civil Rights Attorney. So you're sort of you're sitting at that intersection with how do we take care of our security concerns without infringing on civil rights. What are the questions that have to be asked that are not being asked? What is the frame that's going to make this a fruitful conversation that's really going to shift us away from the path we've tread so far?
Look at history and see what has been effective and what hasn't been effective, and to understand that, you know, solid police work and approaching it from the perspective of actually protecting communities as opposed to scapegoating communities, what that's actually created. I think the reality is my program is called National Security and Civil Rights because national security, it's not an area of law. It's basically a broad-based excuse that the government uses as a trump card, pardon the pun, to really exert extensive powers without being checked by anyone. And so what we do is in every one of those situations, whether it comes up in the employment context, whether it comes up in the detention context, is to say to folks, hey, wait a minute, let's step back. The amount of secrecy and the amount of power that is being asserted by the government in this moment of time, is that warranted? You know, what have we seen historically? What might actually be going on? And why can't we apply our normal rules of process in these circumstances? And I think those are the questions that we need to ask. You know, we've now been going down the road of the same policies with Suspicious Activity Act reporting and if you see something, say something, and reaching out to the Muslim community in very aggressive ways. And we have not really changed the conversation in a positive way. And I think, if anything, folks are more scared than they even used to be. And so we need to go back and look at what has worked and what hasn't worked, and understand that a lot of this discrimination and focus on people in these communities has not been something that has been good for us morally or factually. The one other thing I just want to say is that I did actually use the term concentration camps for Japanese internment. And the reason I did that is because 3 years ago I actually visited a concentration camp, a former concentration camp of Japanese Americans in Tule Lake on the border of Oregon and California. And I went on that trip with about 200 former internees, and that is what the internees call those camps. And technically, my understanding is that the Japanese internment camps were considered concentration camps by those communities. And I think that in itself is an example of how we try to rewrite history in a way that's softer and doesn't take responsibility for what we've actually done. So, you know, applying that to today, let's not get in a situation where we try to redefine things later.
Okay, let's go to a couple of other calls. Again, 415-841-4134. Our phone lines are full right now, but you can keep trying. 415-841-4134. Email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org. Post a comment to the KLW website or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. Let's go to Pat from San Francisco. Pat, welcome to the program.
Yes. One, I wanted to say that I'm white. I'm also trans. So I've experienced prejudice from different people. But I have a neighbors who are Palestinian. I have two doctors that are Jewish, and I've never gotten anything but respect from them. And I've had respect with them also. And that we've discussed religion at times, in part so I can understand, but also so they can understand my perspective of religion. And I don't see how people can be so asinine as to treat people the way they do. I mean, when that whole situation happened down in San Bernardino, yeah, they were Arabic, whoopee. I thought, okay, what kind of sick mind does something like that? Nothing to do with their religion, but their personality.
Thank you, Pat, for your perspective. We have an email from Joe in Richmond that says, do Muslim Americans feel all discrimination is wrong, particularly discrimination against the LGBT community? So this kind of builds a little bit on what Pat was saying, but also on what we were talking about earlier, which is how do we see Islamophobia connected to the other isms, so to speak, that we've alluded to earlier in the program. So, again, going back to you, Zahra Bilou, how do you see coalition building as part of the solution here? Do we have Zahra still?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can. Okay, go ahead, Zahra. Sorry.
So I was just going to say, I think something that Professor Yunus said earlier is that the Muslim community is not a monolith. We're the most diverse religious community in the world, and definitely in the United States in terms of all walks of life. So in the same way that there's no universal, unilateral answer to how do Christians feel about gay rights, that would be the same answer for Muslims, that there's no single answer. But I can say that as a Muslim civil rights attorney, the laws that protect me are the same laws that protect LGBT Americans of any faith or of no faith. They're the laws that protect people who are atheists. They're the laws that protect people who are Jewish and Christian. And so I want everyone to be free from the right, free from discrimination in all contexts, in school, in employment, from law enforcement. And I wanted to be clear in saying that the laws that protect me protect everyone else, and I advocate for everyone's ability to use them and be safe as a result of them. Coalition building, I think, is simple and straightforward. We're American Muslims are willing to work with people who are advocating for civil rights and human rights for all people. In my work, that is a entirely domestic focus that looks at how do we protect all Americans from harassment, from discrimination, from surveillance. And so if folks want to work with us on those issues, we're happy to work with them. I think some of the strongest coalitions have been in the Bay Area, where we have worked with LGBT groups, African-American groups, Christian groups, and others to push back against law enforcement surveillance, to condemn anti-Muslim bus advertisements, and the list goes on. But really, like, my liberation is intertwined with everyone else's, and I'm not free until everyone else is.
Yes, Eunice, go ahead.
I want to point out something that's really very important in within the rubric of how Muslims can become a voice for building coalition and building a common destiny. I think it's a lot of Muslims have a great deal of reservations about being a spokesperson for the religion. Number one, for fear of prosecution. That is real. It's very, very real. I have had conversations with very well educated.
I'm sorry, persecution or prosecution by whom?
By law enforcement being targeted, like people are targeted in the airline.
Okay.
It's just a fear of being boxed. I think that's real. The second element that I have noticed is that even among the very well open-minded, well-educated group of people that I have around me, the subject of Islam is very uncomfortable for them. And I have to wonder why. Why is it so uncomfortable? I think I can understand it at some level because there has been so much pain in the world. There has been so much drama in the world, and it's somehow all connected to the Middle East and Islam. And I think people are really very confused. And I don't think this is the job of a local radio station or a small organization. This is the job of the entire United States government and everything that represents the voices of America. That is the job of the mainstream media. The educators who put the curriculum together for K and 12, that is their job. Our representative who represent us and go and fight on our behalf, that's their job. It is not the job of small entities and small organizations. It is the job that is bigger, it's very complicated, and it needs a village. It needs a village.
I'm assuming you're saying not to the exclusion of voices from local public radio.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But
let's go to another caller. Let's go to Parsa in Menlo Park. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I have a question for you. You actually left a comment there that noting, has anyone of the panelists that actually lived in a Muslim country?
What's behind your comment?
So here's my thing. I'm actually an Iranian myself. I lived in Iran for 15 years. But I do notice the differences. When I lived in this country, of course, the level of rights and freedoms are by far greater than living in a Muslim country. And I think part of the problem is that we, at least upon the people who are Muslims who have come here, I feel there's a certain feeling that any Islamic country at the moment, you have almost no rights, absolutely no rights, in terms of freedom of speech, freedom of religion. And so, excuse me. And so my question is this, that I know that we're obviously living in this country, we need to have our freedom of, you know, religion, freedom of speech, and so on, but I never hear the other side, the fact that we need a reformation in Islam to basically fix the problems that exist.
And when you say problems that exist in Islam, what do you mean?
So, for example, I'll give you an example. In Bangladesh, there's been sort of a series of murders of secular bloggers, and unfortunately, it's been going on for years now, 2 years now, and there has been nothing done about it. In Iran, of course, you have a lot of persecution based on religion. And in many Muslim countries, in fact, in all of them, you have no freedom of expression in any sense that goes against the Islamic teachings.
Okay. I appreciate your question, and I'm going to have you take your answer off the air. Let's go ahead. Eunice, you want to jump in here, and then I want to get the other two guests to respond.
Yeah, to answer the guest question, I am from Morocco. I grew up in a Muslim country, and I have lived and done research on the Muslim world. So I have a direct experience of what it means to be Muslim and what it means to live within a Muslim environment. I think what the caller is not a very important distinction to be made regarding the comment that the caller made. When Islam spread beginning in the late 8th century to the 9th century, it has never sought to change local customs and local language and local traditions. The motto of Islamic spread was adaptation. We created a religion for you that would live and survive in anywhere and any time. So adapt it. And there is a very important component in Islam called ijtihad, which is this whole idea of reformation. And we have seen movement of reformation across Islamic history. that has sadly stopped. That's very important to point out. So just because something is happening in a Muslim world, it does not mean it's Muslim.
Or it's not related to Islam specifically.
For example, female genital mutilation is not an Islamic practice. There is nothing in the Quran that says that women need to be circumcised. And there is nothing in the Quran that says that men need to be circumcised either. However, these are local traditions that were preserved because Islam did not seek to change the local traditions.
So, Zahra, really briefly, I want you to respond. When you get, you must hear some of this type of questioning of saying, well, let's shine some light on civil rights issues in the Muslim world. Why aren't we focusing there? Help us add to Eunice's perspective.
So I would agree with what Eunice said. It's just because something happens somewhere by Muslims, in the same way that we don't blame 1.6 billion Muslims for the actions of an individual, we don't blame 1.6 billion Muslims or the religion of Islam for the actions of a nation state. I think it's really important to take a step back and think about, if I'm looking at this as an American, it raises a few questions for me. One, let's get clear that this is not the Muslim world or the Islamic world. These are Muslim-majority countries, many of whose governments are propped up by our own. And for me, like, if I want to stay sane as an activist, but also if I want to stay focused, I have to choose an area of focus. I'm an American Muslim. I was born and raised in the United States. I have spent more time in North America than anywhere else. And so my focus is on human rights concerns here. If I hear of a Muslim family that is engaged in female genital mutilation in the United States, it is a concern to me. If I hear of a police officer who kills an unarmed black man in the United States, it is of concern to me. And so my area of focus is in the United States.
Okay.
That people are welcome to focus on Saudi Arabia. That's not a country that I'm friends with. I'm a critique of those countries. So I think that it's important to have a nuanced conversation. We can't just say, let's ignore civil rights and human rights issues in the United States because Saudi Arabia is horrible, too. For me, the solution is let's stop funding those countries.
Okay. We're running out of time, unfortunately. I wanted to get one last caller on. Ed, do we have Ed on the line from Berkeley?
Yes. Ed, hi.
Really quickly, like 15
very quickly,
seconds.
I just like to say two questions very fast. Who benefits from the action of this bloody murderer, Daesh or ISIS or whatever? Second, why is it happening now, in the last year, where you have the extreme uprising of right wing in the U.S. and Europe? You know why? Most of the followers of this people are a bunch of idiots, have no idea of Islam, they're just blind idiots. But the leaders of ISIS or ISIL or whatever, they paid agents for Israel, for the United States, for the West, for Saudi Arabia. And you know, you can tell why they killed 500,000 Muslims, they never shot single shot at Israel, which is killing Palestinians every day. This is my comment.
Okay, thank you so much, Ed. So I want, what do we have, like a minute and a half there? Okay, so minute and a half, that's going to give everyone about 20 seconds. So Eunice, you go first, then we'll go to Zahra and Nasreena, you get the last word.
Well, I just want to take us back to the birth of Islam. When Islam came into being, the landscape was an incredible jungle in the Arabian Peninsula. They were people that were buried alive. They were incredible injustices. And Islam came and have given people some rights, women some rights, the elderly some rights, the right to exist, the right to conduct business, the right to worship. The whole notion of Islam has been based on this fundamental human right.
Zahra, you get another comment, 10 seconds. You there, Zahra? Did we lose Zahra? We keep losing Zahra. Nasreena.
No, I'm still here.
Go ahead.
Thank you for having this conversation. I hope it's the first of many.
We'll bring you back for sure. And Nasreena, you get the last word.
I would just encourage our public officials and our ordinary citizens to speak out. Each of our social media and life interactions is a platform from which to push back on bigotry and hate, and I hope every one of us chooses to do that.
Well, I want to thank our guests tonight, Zahra Belu of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Nasreena Barghzi with the Asian Law Caucus, and Eunice Murshid of Cal State East Bay. For a link to this and other City Vision shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David Latulip. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join me next Monday as I speak with Stanford Dean and author Julie Lithcock-Hames about her new book, on overparenting entitled How to Raise an Adult. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.